Howard, do you want to start? Press star 6.
I had star 8 for some reason. Hi, this is, we're at our 9th meeting of our Thibault book study, and we're in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sorry, I'm scattered here. Here we are. We're in Alcoholics Anonymous, an experiment of nature honor, about page 78, with the paragraph starting in 1933. We've been looking at Thibault's advice to therapists about how to handle the distinction between Freud's ego and the big ego that he's talking about that needs reducing. So, he's actually in the middle of 4 points. The need to hit bottom, the need to be humble, the need to surrender, and the need for the primary ego to be reduced. So we're in that last point. And we're ready to go. Who should start? Oh, Suzanne, you got the order? Is that me? I think so.
You'll start.
Okay. So in 1933, Rideau could be and was more explicit about this primary narcissism and what must happen to it. He wrote, "Once it, the original ego, was a being radiant with self-esteem, full of belief in the omnipotence of its wishes, of its thoughts, gestures, and words." Freud had summed it up in the phrase, "His Majesty the Baby." After this description, Rideau continues with the phrase, "But the child's megalomania," a direct reference to the big head or big ego of the infant that the infant has at birth, and then in the sequel, he specifically makes the ego the target and uses the word reduction to describe what must take place. This process, quote, "this process first described by Freud may be designated the reduction in the size of the original ego. It is a painful procedure and one that is possibly never carried out," quote. So he's quoting Rideau there. And incidentally, he had said that reduction could produce a more modest self-evaluation, which certainly indicates that the individual becomes more humble. There is no doubt that he had a feel for what happens within the person as the narcissistic ego elements are reduced. I'm going to go one more. In passing, it may be of interest to note the choice of the words departure and reduction. Freud spotted the area of change and said it must be departed from. Rideau, from the vantage of many years later, said the change must be a reduction, a clear statement about the direction of the departure. Rideau even used the word size when he speaks of the original ego, a word which appears in the phrase, "cuts down to size." A well-known colloquialism then vividly suggests what happens to the big ego. Yes.
So I want to just talk about when, you know, how do we see this in our daily work of with the steps? And I know that, like, for me, I notice my ego the most when I'm scanning my day, looking at 10 steps and looking at things that are bothering me, whether they're big things or whether they're even kind of little things. And I was just wondering if what other people do with that and with any, you know, of this material. I think the other place where I really kind of look at ego and I don't think for me I just kind of put everything in the category of ego. I don't always separate like His Majesty the baby, the ego with a giant or a capital E on it. So I was just wondering if anybody else what they do with that. And I know I, by reading this material, I definitely become more and more aware of what's kind of going on. I have a new awareness of my ego that I didn't before. I you know, yes, it's kind of under that category of selfish or wanting things my way, but it seems like I have more information now. And I really do like the part where he says he's talking too about the original ego, because I feel like that's what I'm really trying to get back to in, you know, working a 12-step program. And this line, once it, the original ego was a being radiant with self-esteem, full of belief in the omnipotence of its wishes, of its thoughts, gestures, and words. And I think that's where I'm, you know, I want to have that radiant self-esteem, and I also want to have that full belief in a higher power. So that's what I got out of that. Thanks.
Yeah, this is Howard. First of all, I really like, he gets poetical there, you know. Once it was a being radiant with self-esteem, full of belief in the omnipotence of its wishes. Well, this is what he's describing as the infantile ego. Now, a sense of childish wonder and worth, you know, is not necessarily what he's talking about. He's talking about the aspects of the infantile ego that are a problem when brought into adulthood, which is, you know, what we've been talking about, all those ego factors. The feeling of omnipotence and I'm all powerful, you know, and just this extreme self-obsession that we suffer from. And, you know, Thibaut's looking at this thing psychologically and saying this is where it comes from. So, you know, as far as ego, you know, I'm not sure that's not all that's wrong with me. My basic problem is I've got a separation from God and my fellows. I have a spiritual difficulty. But what does that look like inside my head? It looks like, you know, a big part of it is ego, and there are other aspects. But I was, when prepping for this, later on there's a reference, but in step 7 of the 12x12, there's indeed the attainment of greater humility is the foundation principle of each of AA's 12 steps. So humility is a reduction in ego. So I think it's a real big part. I'm looking for humility, and my ego gets in the way of that. So when do I notice it? I do spot checks. You know, if I have a thought that makes me uncomfortable, and if I'm aware and in tune and working, you know, a program, a spiritual program, which isn't all the time, but if I am, I become aware of, you know, for instance, did that person smile at me or did they frown at me? And they're probably frowning about something else, but I'm the center of the universe, right? So, you know, that's my ego grabbing on to the world and trying to change it for my own benefit, right? It's like, or my own confusion, right? I have to look and, from the feelings, when they give me bad feelings, I need to look and see where my part in it is. And frequently that part is that my ego is making assumptions about the world and that I'm seeing through the lens of ego. I'm seeing, you know, I believe I'm more powerful in the situation than I am. I have omnipotence. I believe that, you know, I don't want to be put off. I don't want to be stopped and so forth, all those ego factors. It's not the whole story, though. It's like, you know, well, you know, the solution is spiritual, and for me, to reduce that ego, to go to humility. But that's all I got.
Yeah, I agree with you that it is a, like, with step 10, it's like what I have is a spiritual separation. And I think mm-hmm. what studying this work does for me is with when it brings out the ego, it helps me like more quickly tune into the fact that tune into to when my self-talk talk is off.
Mm-hmm.
Because what I try to do is try to stay as connected to that self-talk during the day, but it's like I definitely get off course. And it seems like I just am more aware more quickly by studying.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful for that. Thank you.
Right. The knowledge helps a lot. Me too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'll continue. In passing, it may be of interest to note the choice of the words departure and reduction. Freud spotted the area of change and says it must be departed from Rado from the vantage of many years later. Said the change must be a reduction, a clear statement about the direction of the departure. Do you understand that, Howard, because I don't?
Yeah, well, when Freud was discussing the infantile ego, he said that the ego had to be modified to work in the adult, and that the narcissistic elements that he identified with the phrase His Majesty the Baby, we say King Baby, had to be departed from, that is, separated from the other, the healthy aspects of the ego. And, he's saying that later, Rado comes along and looks at that and says, well, you know, what you gotta do, it's, you depart from it, but you do that by reducing it. So it's the direction of the departure that he's noting here. That the ego has to be, that infantile ego has to be reduced.
Thank you. So Rado even uses the word size when he speaks of the original ego, a word which appears in the phrase cuts down to size, a well-known colloquialism that vividly suggests what happens to the big ego. The experience of a patient who had a slip is clinically illustrating the meaning of ego reduction. A slip, of course, is a short or long period of drinking by an alcoholic who has had a period of sobriety of some duration. It is seldom, if ever, willed, and very often occurs without obvious external reason. A woman in her early 40s had done well under a regimen of
disulfiram.
And psychotherapy. She was pleased with her progress and was toying with the idea of terminating the psychotherapy since she was not sure she still needed it. I'm really glad that he takes and he's, you know, kind of explaining the concept, and then here he gives a kind of pretty down-to-earth example of a slip, which I can definitely relate to.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I really like about it is that he says it is seldom, if ever, willed, and very often occurs without obvious external reason.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really critical line because I don't think, you know, a lot of people in the program don't totally understand that. You know, they
think peculiar twist of mind that precedes the first drink.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Anybody have any comments or Terry, would you like to continue reading?
Sure. During the summer recess, the patient stopped taking the disulfiram tablets and was slack about attending game meetings. I had done so well, I thought they weren't urgent anymore, was her subsequent explanation. Then one day, for no apparent reason, she took a drink. This proved not disastrous because after a couple of days of struggle, she was able through AA help to quit drinking. And soon was dutifully taking disulfiram again. However, she promptly made However, she promptly... Go ahead.
Never mind. Sorry, I'm horning in. That's an abuse, as we learned last time, or I learned.
Okay. However, do you want me to continue the next paragraph, Suzanne and Shaw?
Yeah. Do two more paragraphs, please.
Okay. However, she promptly made sure she was on the autumn schedule in which she appeared for her first interview was full of the story she had to tell. You know, she said, no one was more surprised than I was when I took that first drink. Everything had been fine and I had no worries at all. Then I decided to have a drink and I did. For the life of me, I can't tell you why, because I really didn't enjoy it. She then went on, even as I was taking that drink, I was asking myself why I was doing this. I wondered what explanation Dr. Thibault would have for this. Then I suddenly remembered a dream I had that night before, and I wondered if it had any significance. Here it is. I wrote it down right away.
So why don't you keep on going?
Okay. This is what she has written. I was looking at a suit of armor that was scattered all over the floor. I was trying to reassemble it and finally did. The message of this dream is clear. Once she reassembled her nice hard covering, her ego in the popular sense was again intact, and at the point she could take a drink and did. As the patient grasped the significance of her dream, her eyes twinkled and she said, you know, the word reassemble is not a word I very often use. But as I was writing the dream down, I came to trying to say what happened to that armor, and the world reassembled came into my mind. I thought it rather odd, but I wrote it down just as you have told me to. It makes a lot more sense to me now than it did when I put it down. I guess my unconsciousness knew what had happened all right, although I certainly was not aware of it when I took that first drink.
I want to go back to the statement that is made when she went out and drank, and there's a sentence right after that, it says, let's see, however, she promptly made sure she was on my autumn schedule, and when she appeared for the first interview was full of the story she had to tell, you know, she said, no one was more surprised than I was when I took that drink. Everything had been fine, and I had no worries, and I decided to have a drink, and I did. For the life of me, I can't tell you why, because I really didn't enjoy it. And then I thought somewhere it said, I'm just having a hard time finding it. Oh, okay, here it is. It's in the paragraph before. It's then for one day, for no apparent reason, she took a drink. This proved not disastrous, because after a couple of days of struggle, she was able, through AA, help to quit drinking. And I think I didn't realize that she wasn't, when I first heard it, I didn't realize that she hadn't been in AA. So it was with AA she was able to quit. What I thought was that she had kind of slipped. Whoops.
No, that's right. She had been in AA.
Oh, she had been in AA. Okay, so she slipped. But I think usually when we, you know, we hear in the program, oh, if you take, you know, the first drink, you're going to, you're not going to know when you're going to come back. You're, you know, going to wreak havoc, this, that, and the other thing, which I think does happen to some people. But I also think, and I don't really think we hear a lot about it, is that sometimes when people do go out, they do what this woman, her experience was that she took that drink. It wasn't that disastrous initially. But I think what happens here, what she doesn't say, is that her mind Because after a couple of days of struggle, it's like, was it her mind that was struggling, or was it her ego that was coming in telling her, you know, that she didn't have to go back to AA, or that, you know, obviously it's her ego that's telling her that, oh, yeah, you know, you can have, you know, one drink or whatever. But the fact that she came back is great. But I think the other thing is that I think when you have that experience of being able to go out and nothing really bad happening, I think sometimes it's harder to stay, get yourself clean again, because it's easy to get into that mindset of coming back into play, saying, oh, you did it, you know, a couple of weeks ago, and, mm-hmm. you know, hell didn't break loose, so, you know, just all that kind of stuff. So, thanks. That was
certainly my experience with this. My first slip was just like that. And the one after that, was a lot more serious. But what I love about this section is that it's an illustration of the insanity that precedes the first drink. And all of the things he's been saying are coming together here in a practical demonstration. He's, you know, that wonderful dream about reassembling the armor, he's going to interpret that and show us how that ego is working around that slip. And I just, it just dovetails so well with what's in the book. You know, it's a classic example of alcoholic insanity. So I just love this section.
Bob, I was just going to say that, Howard. This reminded me of, you know, that the classic part of the book where it's talking about the strange mental blank spot, because that's what she had. She didn't know why she took that drink, and, you know, the insanity preceded the drink. And, you know, it just reminds me so much of when I first started recovery, I was told I had to be humble in order to do what I was going to be told to do. And I had to get rid of the ego. And humility was huge in that, because without that, I still think my mind tells me that I know better, or that I think I can do my way, and I don't need to do what I'm told or what anyone else told me to do. And so humility was huge for me. Not so much that I, you know, was a big braggart or swagger, but just the fact that we hold on to the idea that until we come in here and surrender, our mind tells us that we have control and choice when we really don't, and got to get that powerlessness. You know, this was, and her experience, this woman's experience, it's so typically classic of what you hear from people who mm-hmm. who have a relapse, where she, you know, she was doing well. So now, and maybe she didn't get all the way through, probably didn't get all the way through the program yet. You know, it says we have to get rid of our ego, you know, ego in order to do a self-evaluation. I mean, how else would I be able to do that fourth step if my ego is telling me I'm okay, there's nothing wrong with me, I didn't harm anybody, I didn't hurt anybody, I don't have resentments, I'm not angry. So how to get rid of that so I could look at my own role. But this woman was like classic, you know, I was doing well, so I didn't think I had to go to meetings anymore. And classic, you know, ask people when they relapse, what happened? And every time, if they had been through the steps, they stopped working with others. Then they stopped going to meetings. Then they stopped calling their network. Then they stopped calling their sponsor. And before you know it, they're running life on their own will again. And because they think they've gotten control over this disease. And we know from experience that you can't. So that's the ego coming back, mushrooming back, you know, growing again. And, you know, like you see so many times, I think I agree with Suzanne that it almost seems like if it grows back bigger and stronger, and it's harder to mm-hmm. harder to cut it down to size again.
And especially if you're successful, or quote, successful, end quote.
And I have a question about that. I'd like to hear your all of your comments on this. What mm-hmm. happens to the program person who comes in, is on the ground, rebuilds their life, and the difference, like I know the difference between success that's not ego-driven and success that's God-driven. I know for myself, I definitely see when I'm connected into self that is ego-driven, which is not what I'm interested in really doing anymore, versus there's a whole different ease for me personally when I'm in success that's God-driven. I was just wondering if anybody else has any comments on that.
Hi, this is Stephanie. I had a hard time unmuting. But I just wanted to comment before we moved on about, you know, when we were reading this, a woman in her early 40s, so it says she'd done well under regimen of AA. She's on anabuse and psychotherapy. What stuck out for me was she was pleased with her progress and was toying with the idea of terminating the psychotherapy since she was not sure she still needed it. It doesn't say, but it sounded like I'm not sure if she was toying with the idea of terminating while she was in treatment with Dr. Tebow or while they were on, you know, was it after the recess? But for me, you know, doing my program alone is never a good idea. That is really an opportunity for my ego to regenerate itself when I have these grand ideas about, you know, who I think I am and what I think I've accomplished on my own strength. It's also interesting because it, you know, she kind of, it's sort of the way it's described is like, you know, I don't know what happened. Everything was fine for no apparent reason. Well, the buildup of her ego started before she took that drink. Mm-hmm. It started with her, you know, not going to meetings, not going to therapy, not doing the anabuse. And we all know the anabuse is supposed to be making you violently ill if you take it. So that was a very planned stopping. Anyways, that's it.
Yeah, well, right. There are warning signs in her narrative, what she was saying, and especially I had done so well, I thought they weren't urgent anymore, any of those things, like AA. So it's clear. This is a classic. This is, you know, right by the book. And it's cool to see how Tebow integrates that into his psychiatric view of how the ego is working. Let's have it in the next paragraph.
You know, somebody is, there's just some noise in the background. And so if everybody can just be mindful of remembering to mute, that would be great. Okay, let's see. Stephanie, would you like to continue?
Okay, where the dream, of course.
Yeah.
Are we at the dream? The dream, of course, illustrates the opposite of ego reduction. The reduced ego, scattered, unintact, made sobriety possible, but the patient was unable to maintain that state. Just like the man who said he was going to get drunk after being praised, this patient could not stand the prosperity of sobriety. She was on her own, and there was no doctor, no AA, no disulfiram as a chemical fence, no daily reminder that would keep that ego down. And she did not have the capacity to keep it down by herself, a fact she had yet to learn. Once her ego got unreduced or reassembled, she was headed for trouble, which came the very next day. Her unconscious knew what it was doing when it injected the word reassembled into her thinking. It was stating, the period of reduction is over, and now I can reassert myself. A drink the next day was the outcome. At one time, not long ago, the message of this dream might have been lost. With the role of the narcissistic aspect of the ego better understood, it is possible to pick up such messages. This dream was particularly striking because its antecedents could be readily identified and its effect upon the unconscious was easily determined by the onset of drinking the next day. Pass.
Terry, would you like to, let's see, Bob, would you like to continue?
This is Howard. I'd just like to note quickly that Angie did not have the capacity to keep it down by herself, full stop. Actually, there's a comma, but in my mind, full stop. It's, you know, we're powerless.
Great.
You ready?
Would you like? Yes.
Sure. Another patient had a different reaction to the issue of ego reduction. She had been in AA for many years and had come for help because she suffered from periods of tension bordering on panic. She had been under treatment for some time when she began to face more concretely the problems of ego reduction. Characteristically, this process is often equated with the fall of man from his high estate, i.e. loss of omnipotence. The patient ushered in this phase with a dream in which she reported, "My niece fell off a ladder." The patient had a strong identification with this niece, who was practically a daughter. It was quite evident who was falling. The next dream found the patient visiting a dentist. There was also something about a funeral in the dream. The inner response to ego reduction was now being revealed. Teeth often stand for bite and in turn stand for strength, i.e. bite your teeth into it. Anyone going to a dentist is receiving attention for his bite. That is, something is threatening it with impairment. At the same time, the patient has death in the offing, a direct reference to the belief that if the ego falls, it is the equivalent of psychic death. Actually, of course, this is the part of the ego the individual must lose if he is to mature. The patient's reaction to falling is to fear death and to seek dental attention in the hope that her bite can be repaired. The immediately following dream began with the statement, drinking. The patient had her own method of recapturing her bite by taking a drink. Fortunately, this proved only a dream act, although the patient reported general uneasiness extending over several days. This case again illustrates how unconscious reactions may be deciphered if the therapist is alert to the theme of the fall and rise of the ego elements that stem from the original narcissism. These elements wage a constant battle. Their presence, actual or potential, is a factor always to be kept in awareness.
Any comments, Howard?
Yeah, so this is another dream interpretation. Somebody was fighting against the ego death. You know, I'm totally relate. You know, it's like, what about me? I'll become like the hole in the donut, right? It feels like death to let go of my ego. You know, there's no distinction in my mind when I'm coming in young and sobriety between that ego and myself. It's actually not myself. It's this aspect of my ego that I have to lose, you know. And I think elsewhere he talks about, this idea of becoming your true self. I think that's maybe in the next paper. But, I became my true self when I, the first time I got to the ego reduction. I was able to clear my vision of my self-obsession and look at reality, look at what was really happening with me, you know, do my fourth and fifth step and ended up finding myself, it was crucial growing up. You know, I was 32, 33 before I grew up. But yeah, so that's, we're just watching that process again. And the what's interesting to me is this resistance that he's showing there, that this patient is showing, and his analysis of it.
Would you like to continue reading discussion?
Okay. Discussion. This discussion of ego reduction has completed the presentation of the four insights that grew out of a study of the conversion process first witnessed in AA. To recapitulate, these are 1, the need to hit bottom, 2, the need to be humble, 3, the need to surrender, and 4, the need for the primary ego to be reduced. Bringing them all together but slightly transposing their order, we can say that a conversion occurs when the individual hits bottom, surrenders, and thereby has his ego reduced. His salvation lies in keeping that ego reduced and staying humble. And that was where I looked up the step 7 reference. You know, indeed, the attainment of greater humility is the foundation principle of each of AA's 12 steps. So I think crucially that's the rest of the AA program in a nutshell right there. And it's Thibaut doesn't go into detail about that. He's more concerned with the early stages, but there we are. There's the rest of the 12 steps. So I'll go on. These insights gained from a long study of Alcoholics Anonymous and the process it initiates appear to give meaning and order to the change that AA induces. Conversion is no longer an event out of the blue, but a logical outgrowth of human responses, hitting bottom, and surrender. Pass.
Oh, I just wanted to say that line, his salvation lies in keeping that ego reduced and staying humble. That to me, it's that recuperative power of the ego. And once again, it goes back to why it's so important, why I have to be really on top of those 10 steps if I want to, especially if I'm bothered by stuff, if things are bothering me. So I'll continue reading. This does not imply complete comprehension of the mysteries of the conversion process. That's still... Hold on just a second. That still remains a marvel about which many questions have yet to be answered. But this understanding seems to touch on some of the forces at work, forces that evidently are of profound importance to man. If this understanding only scratches the surface of these psychological events, it nevertheless seems to tell a great deal about how man changes. 2 issues raised by the preceding discussion require particular attention. 1st, the specific problem of how the word ego should be handled in clinical practice. 2nd, the general problem of the therapeutic situation, especially in its earliest phase with surrender and ego reduction in mind. Any comments? I'll continue then. The word... Go ahead.
Sorry. That goes in with his focus on the early stages, and his sort of summary of the rest of the steps is keeping the ego reduced. But
yeah, and I think that's what we learn to do in, when we're working a program and continually working the program is, we're constantly, pushing that ego down. And I can't remember who talks about it, but, it's like the balloon of the ego where, it pushes up and then, there's that, it's always kind of coming up and there's always that kind of push down. Terry, would you like to continue?
The problem of the word ego should be tackled early. For instance, one aspect of the narcissistic ego is that it must be the master, must feel that it is in control. Very commonly, a patient's first dream will demonstrate this point. Typically, he will be driving a car, i.e., be in the driver's seat, and then will get out, thereby showing that in therapy, he must forego for a while running his life his own say-so. When a dream of this type occurs, it is appropriate to alert the patient to the feelings which are aroused when one is driving a car, the sense of well-being, the headiness that comes from being the boss man. Easily grasp what is meant in his puzzle that the therapist should raise any question about that side of his nature. The matter may be allowed to rest there for a while. As time goes on, the patient realizes that there are other less desirable aspects of the same ego elements. They are domineering and pushy. They withstand frustration poorly. Basically, they cause him to be afraid of his own shadow, or more accurately, of his own drives that he soon learns are rather imperious forces pass.
Stephanie, would you like to continue?
As this awareness grows, the individual commences to detach himself from these elements and to discover that he has another side that is a little quieter, a little less strenuous, a little more patient, and a little less in need of having all the answers and being in control. This may be referred to, for the patient's benefit, as the other self or just the self, sometimes as the more sensible side or the less driven part of one's nature. This self is the ego that appears as the original ego is modified, and this newly emerging ego should never be identified with the word ego. It is too confusing for patients. Instead, with them, the word ego should be confined to its more popular meaning. They catch on without trouble, and in a relatively short time, are thinking in terms of ego reactions and non-ego ones. They go around spotting big fat egos in everyone and begin to see more clearly how ego of this type concerns themselves. Pass.
Well, there's a couple things there. I'm going to go around and spot big egos everywhere. That's a little off track, I think. But, this Kindle, it jumps around. This idea, what he's talking about then is the technical psychiatric definition of ego versus the narcissistic ego that, you know, he's talking about. And basically, in psychiatric terms, what is left after you reduce the narcissistic ego is the true ego, the one that works in Freudian terms. Right, and that patients shouldn't think of it in that terms. They should think of it in terms of self. You know, it's a tricky business with words there. I think, and I don't entirely agree with the divisions, but, you know, the point is that, the alcoholic emerges with a different self, with a different character, you know. That, you know, we work upon. And so anyway, that's all.
This line, they go around spotting big fat egos in everyone. And that makes me think of being judgmental. And which takes me into when I'm judging other people, when I'm in a meeting sitting judging other people, mm-hmm. I'm in ego. So that's what I got from that. Bob, would you like to continue?
As therapy continues, if it is going well, the ego they first encountered in themselves slowly recedes and they become more and more identified with the other self, which is growing as a real element in their makeup. The time comes, ideally, when this new self supersedes the former, and the individual is free from the harassment of the big ego he once had. This description of the course of therapy is not new. The only step that may be different is the aim to get the patient as soon as possible to realize that his concept of ego is not one that can be maintained, and that he must eventually find another self free from the unhealthy elements that he formerly took for granted, as he did being in the driver's seat. When the original ego is identified early in therapy, the problem of nomenclature drops out. Patients fairly quickly recognize the two aspects of ego, although in practice they seldom call the new ego by that term. They will say instead, some of me is coming through, and are more regardful of how they feel rather than how they ought to feel. The other self is slowly taking shape, and they are getting more and more in touch with it. Pass.
Howard, would you like to continue?
Okay. Oh, darn. I moved the mouse and things jump around. Okay.
I can continue.
Description of Kurt. No, I've got it. When the original ego is identified early in therapy, the problem of nomenclature drops out. Patients fairly quickly recognize the two aspects of ego. Oh, we did that already. This is the self that needs support. That's right, huh? I think so. This
right.
is the self that needs support from the therapist. The support can be direct or indirect. In my experience, the most effective help the newly emerging self can receive is through an indirect approach. If the narcissistic side is reduced, the new self circumstantially has a chance to grow. To be sure, such growth may well be nurtured, but if the weeds of the original ego are removed, the other self will develop with little or no urging. Every therapy springs from some form of hitting bottom. A patient is brought to seek help either by the distress his symptoms create or by the exigencies of his life situation. In other words, every patient is motivated by a sense of crisis, which takes the form of not wanting the present situation to continue as it is. A change seems preferable, and the patient has not found a way of bringing it about by himself. He must seek help. I'm going to go on. Now, the seeking of help is anathema to the strong narcissistic ego, which would go it alone. Recoiling from help is a sign of weakness. As a consequence, the very seeking of help is an act of surrender, a giving up, and produces a characteristic chain of reactions. A graphic example is in the second list of words by the patient who consented to seek help: at peace, relaxed, receptive, and so forth. So that seems pretty significant to me, you know, the whole idea of surrender and asking for help, you know, in step one, you know, I'm powerless over alcohol, help, you know, is the beginning of ego reduction. And continuing to rely, you know, not on one's own resources or ego, and seeking help elsewhere, and principally in a higher power, but also in other people, is the way I move forward in AA. So I like those couple of paragraphs. They speak to me.
I also like the idea of looking at how I need, like, when do I need help? I think it's really easy for the ego to come into play, and I can be in much more pain than I need to be if I'm not just humble and quickly reach out for help. It's like I can make myself more miserable, actually, when I kind of get into those thoughts of embarrassment or shame or, you know, whatever else that self-talk, you know, keeps me inside of myself.
Self-pity.
Yeah, self-pity, that's a good one, too. Mm-hmm. And it's like, and the clue for me was, like, I could hear the word self-pity. I could hear all those words, but yet there was a way that I was able to deny that I was in them. Like, I didn't really know, like, when I was really in self-pity, and it's like when I really was able to put together, okay, this is when I'm in self-pity, when I'm saying blah, 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 blah. You know, that's what it looks like. And that's why it was so important for me to be talking with other people and to have other people, you know, point that out. It really, really helped me see what, you know, what the words really look like in my personal life. Because I think for me it was just so easy, or, you know, it's been just so easy to think I understand the information, especially like intellectually. And it's like, you know, that's kind of fine and dandy, but it doesn't get me to the place when I, the same place that I'm in when I see it, when I'm actually experiencing it, when I actually say, oh, yeah, that, you know, I finally get it. Okay. Go ahead.
Me? Okay, so we got just four paragraphs left. I'll try to charge through them. I mean, we're short on time, so maybe that's not the right thing to do if we need to talk about it. We'll see. In that frame of mind, the prospective patient is a good candidate for therapy. He quickly takes on the therapist, develops a transference, and enters the honeymoon phase of treatment, mainly because he has quit fighting and has turned to another for help. He's given up, is no longer going it alone. He has surrendered, in fact, if not consciously. The surrender, however, is seldom permanent. The motivation arising from the sense of crisis vanishes with the earliest improvement. The armor is reassembled, and the treatment is blocked by a phase of resistance. The conflict between the forces that seek help and those that fight it is now joined, and the battle of treatment is on. In other words, at the start of therapy, the issue of surrender is immediately faced. The subsequent course of treatment can be predicted to a very considerable extent if the roles of hitting bottom, humility, surrender, and ego reduction are kept in mind as essential features in a therapeutic experience. Summary, based on observations of Alcoholics Anonymous, as its program has affected change in many members and from clinical experience with alcoholic patients, a hypothesis is formulated concerning the effective psychological events that make possible the maintenance of sobriety. Four elements are recognized as playing an essential role: hitting bottom, surrender, ego reduction, and maintenance of humility. The application of this conceptualization in individual psychotherapy is discussed and illustrated with case material. End of chapter.
Well, thank you. Anybody have any final comments? All I know is that I have to be pretty clear on when I hit bottom. I'm clear as to knowing my process for how I surrender. I'm learning, you know, more about ego reduction, although I do think ego reduction is a result of when we... Well, I heard something today that said, like, actually every step is a step of ego reduction. And I think even walking into the room, a 12-step room, there's an ego. That's a form of ego reduction. And step four, step five, step nine, those are all forms of ego reduction, too. So thanks.
Step seven, too, of course, humbly asked and remote. And that quote from the 12 by 12, it's humility is the foundation principle of every step.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, so there's something that makes me a little uncomfortable about this is that he's talking about surrender to the therapist, which always raises my hackles a little bit, you know, and it's because I think I probably have trust issues still. But really, what we're talking about is surrender to a higher power, but also you know, to reality and to help from people, sponsor fellow alcoholics. So. That's all I got.
Great. Anybody else? Then we'll say the Serenity Prayer together and finish up. Bob, would you like to lead us?
Sure.
God,
grant me the serenity.
Serenity.
To accept the things
accept
I
the
cannot
things.
Change.
Not change.
Cannot change.
The courage to change the things
I can.
And the wisdom to know the
difference. To know the difference.
Hey.
All right.
Cool.